Good evening.
This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At the time we begin the tech net, for those who have questions or comments, the way you get your question addressed, usually answered, is to give me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, and the yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like K2KEY, Mel, and yes. So do we have any check-ins at the time? Please give me your call letters and name.
Yes, and good evening. This is K2KEY with a comment to begin with, Dick.
Very fine. Mel recognized. Anyone else?
W2PNJ, Bob. No comment yet.
Very fine, Bob, but maybe we'll create a question where you're rolling. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name, please. Fantastic. QGZ with a yes. Okay, looking forward to that question, Bill. It's probably going to be a beauty. Anyone else?
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Okay, Steve. Another one of the big questioners. Okay. Just wait you get those questions from Bill and Steve and Mel. Oh, boy. Who else is going to check in tonight? Give me a call letters and name, please. Okay, we got more than enough to get going. One last call. Anyone else going to check in? Give me your call letters and name to the TechNet. Did I double with someone? Please give me your call letters and name. Okay, maybe not. Mel, go ahead with your opening comments.
Okay, I guess let's go in the regular mode here. I guess the machine wasn't reset for Eastern Daylight Savings Time. Or Eastern Standard Time, I should say Daylight. I guess we'll just call Eastern Standard Time. Questions last week came in from, we were starting to talk about the handheld antenna analyzers. And I got a couple of emails. So I more or less got some answers for people about using the handheld analyzers, but they're going to have, as I emailed a couple of them, a Smith chart. So for those who out there would like to follow along, if you can dig up a Smith chart with a compass, you'll need a Smith chart and a compass. I'll go through it fairly slow and give you some answers how you can enhance the use of your handheld antenna analyzer. And if you don't have a Smith chart but like to get one so you can follow along with what we're doing, you can go to Google, put in Smith chart, and you can download a copy of it. Okay, and then we get back to it later, Dick. Go ahead, please.
Yep. Very fine. Part of what Mel is referring to is that a transmission line has got a peculiar characteristic. We call it a 50-ohm transmission line, if that's what it happens to be, and you put a 50-ohm pure resistor at the far end. You can sweep the transmission line from every frequency you want, low, medium, and high frequencies, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between it and a 50-ohm resistor. That's if it's properly terminated. Put anything else on the far end of that transmission line except a 50-ohm resistor. Make it a 50-ohm resistor and 1 ohm of reactance, capacitive or inductive, or make it 49 ohms of resistance, any slight deviation, and all of a sudden the length of the line becomes a factor. As you sweep in frequency, now at the frequency where the line is a quarter wavelength long or a half wavelength long, different things happen. You get different impedances, and as such, by the way, I just got a note that Andy said that the machine will not be in the net mode tonight, so we got to be careful. Andy just called me. The machine's going to be in the normal mode, which means every couple of minutes, every minute and a half or so, we got to make sure we wait for the beep. So when the transmission line is anything else, all other kinds of impedances happen. At first, when you hear about this, it sounds complicated as all hell. This guy Smith, a beautiful engineer working for Bell Labs in New Jersey, came up with a chart Smith chart, you're going to be able to know something about why a transmission line behaves the way it does. So Mel's going to get into a little bit more about that in a few minutes. We also got a beautiful report happening that maybe Paul's going to tell us more about, and that is on the day of Halloween, this coming Tuesday at 10 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Griffiths, the administrator of NASA, is going to make a huge decision whether or not he does or does not repair the Hubble Space Telescope. So that issue has come up again. Obviously, most of us wish they would repair it. Let's go to our first questioner tonight. We're going to get back to Bill's question after we get to Bill and Steve. So, Bill, what would you like to know tonight? WB2QGZ in the group. K2LIW in the TechNet. Bill, did I get you at a bad time?
Oh, no, I was just going to let it drop so we didn't time out. Hopefully, easy question. Don't give me too cute, he said. Here's the thing. If we're going to talk about, we'll talk about VSWR, and we can say that we can make a calculation to determine equivalent mismatch loss of an antenna without perfect VSWR, without a perfect match. In other words, we have some reflected power. We can say that for a VSWR of 3-1, we have arbitrarily an additional mismatch loss of, you know, a quarter of a dB or half a dB. I'm assuming that takes into account the fact that that signal is going to bang back and forth in that transmission line and eventually all be radiated. Now, if we're using an unbalanced transmission line with a circulator on the transmitter end, which presents a pretty delectable looking load to that signal coming back down and tries to route it around into another port and a termination, do those same numbers apply? In other words, if we have 5 watts reflected, there is indeed 5 watts returning. Because I have a better match at the other end, or an enticing match at the other end for that signal, can I use that same number of what we want to call equivalent mismatch loss, or does that power really just turn into heat down in the circulator and it really does not radiate? Did that make sense?
Sure did. Made a lot of sense, Bill. This particular area you're getting into right now is very often misunderstood. A number of articles have been written on it, and if they don't use careful vocabulary and good illustrations, they can really lose the point. If your antenna on an end of a 50-ohm coax cable is not exactly a 50-ohm resistor at your particular operating frequency with your state of antenna today, some amount of power will be reflected back. That amount of power that's reflected back, you can calculate it. If somebody tells you the impedance of your antenna, and there's a zillion ways they can tell you the impedance, they can tell you with overall standing wave ratio, that's a scalar number. Or they can give you a vector number. They can tell you the exact impedance. They can tell you that it's a 75 ohms resistance in series with 25 ohms of capacitance. In any of those cases, if you're a little bit skilled with mathematics, you can calculate the voltage reflection ratio. Once you know the voltage reflection ratio, you can square that voltage after normalizing it, so to speak, and you can figure out exactly how much power is flowing in the reverse direction on your transmission line. That's the beginning of the process. Now, what happens to that reverse power? Lots of people will call it reactive. They think it's not real. Well, I can put a directional coupler on there, like a bird wattmeter slug, properly tuned to the right frequency. I could measure the amount of power in the reverse wave, and I could light up a light bulb with it. To me, that's real. You would like to think that your transmitter has been carefully adjusted for a 50-ohm source, of load. That means you have power matched it so that it produces the correct performance, particularly if it's a sideband transmitter. It produces the right amount of linearity when it sees 50 ohms. You have power matched the transmitter for 50 ohms. Let me drop a second. However, almost every transmitter we touch really is not a 50 ohm source. Most transistors are nearly a constant current generator. Most pento tubes, like a 6146, a 4CX250B, or whatever else is your favorite tube, most of them are nearly a constant current generator. That means they produce power, but as a source of signal, if you use good lab instrumentation and you look back into that transmitter, you will see nearly an open circuit. It will not absorb the power. You can't put the power into an open circuit or into a short circuit. So all the power that reflects back to your transmitter does get another chance to reflect off the transmitter, to re-reflect it forward, hit the antenna at least a second time, and get another chance of being radiated. So there are curves in books that will tell you if your transmission line has got 1 dB of loss at your particular frequency because of the length of the line and the kind you're using. Maybe it's a IG8U coax and you're using it at 2 meters and you've got the right amount of length so that the chart tells you it should have 1 dB of loss. And because your antenna is running, we'll say, a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, and the power is going to bounce back and forth on that cable some number of times, your calculated 1 dB of loss for a one-shot pass might become 2 dB of loss because it's making multiple passes and getting a little bit weaker each time, that exact amount of reflected power. You watch that one particular electron that got reflected back, and you watch it get weaker on each bounce, and eventually some of it got radiated, but the overall loss of the line went up to 2 dB. That's if you're only counting line loss due to standing wave ratio. As the transmitter becomes more and more ideal, there are ways you can make a transmitter with quadrature hybrids and whatever so that it looks like a pure 50 ohm source. Or you can use a high quality circulator or isolator. Two slightly different devices, but they have very similar operation. In the case of a circulator, all reflected power, if it's working correctly, ends up going into a termination. It heats up the termination and the power is lost forever. So whether you make your transmitter look like 50 ohms because you've used a good circulator, or because you've used some other design practice to make the transmitter really an exact 50 ohm source, in either of those cases, every single volt that's reflected, you could call it power if you square the voltage and recalculate, every single volt and power that's reflected gets absorbed and lost forever. So now you've got another mechanism of loss, which in some cases can be a lot more severe. So in the case of real transmitters that we usually have,
long wind hit. Repeater time of 0 seconds.
In the case of real transmitters that we all own, when the transmission line is not properly terminated, because the antenna has got some standing wave ratio, the transmitter will see higher and lower impedances and reactive and inductive impedances depending on the length of the line. And of the power that's reflected back to the transmitter, 90-some-odd% of it is not absorbed by the transmitter. It gets re-reflected forward and the antenna gets another chance to radiate it. So you've got multiple pass insertion loss of the transmission line in the realistic world. On top of that, because the transmitter, depending on the length of the line, will see higher and lower impedances, and Mel's going to be telling us more about that when we give him a chance, you will see that a real transmitter seeing higher and lower inductive and capacitive impedances generates a different amount of power. So there's a lot of complicated things going on. Real transmitters, whether they're made out of tubes or transistors, change the power output they generate depending on how you load them. Of the power that's reflected back to the transmitter, the majority of it, most of the time, is re-reflected forward, particularly if you got an older kind of a transmitter where you've got a real tuning and loading control, a real PI output network, like you might have on your afterburner, one of these high-power amplifiers you add to your transmitter. The ones that have tubes and real loading networks, you're rematching the situation, in which case you make it such that almost every single watt coming back from the antenna does get re-reflected forward. So, how much power gets really radiated by your antenna? It's a function of at least three or four factors. How bad is the antenna? How long is the transmission line in wavelength? What is the impedance of the transmitter? How many times is the signal bouncing on the line? And is your transmitter generating a new amount of power because of the impedance it's now seeing because of that visor and that length of line? So what sounds like a fairly simple question, Bill, if you really want a quantitative answer, gets a little nasty, as you can tell. With good instrumentation, with your bird watt meter measuring forward and reverse power, you can pretty much figure out what's going on if you know your line laws and a little bit of extra math. But the main question you were asking is, what does that circulator do? Is it forces the transmitter to be 50 ohm in appearance, and every single watt reflected from the antenna toward the transmitter, in theory, gets turned into heat and is never seen again and is lost forever. And one last comment on this one, and that is, we amateurs call it antenna loss because of standing wave ratio. And we say that the apparent gain of the antenna goes down. And from a black box point of view, when you look at antenna, transmission line, and transmitter, it's accurate and it tells us what's happening. But if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty of definitions, the IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society, the group that's concerned with antennas, says that when you're trying to evaluate the gain of the antenna, you must impedance match it first. Gain is that property you measure of an antenna after it has been impedance matched. If your antenna really has a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, and it loses 1 dB of gain in the real world of where you and I are using it, according to the IEEE definition, that gain is still there. You just made a misuse in the way you hooked it up to your system. So, lots of funny things going on. You probably have a couple more questions on this, Bill, and I guarantee this is not all clear the first time you hear it. You may have to ask the question a couple more times, and that's okay. So be B2QGZ, K2LAW on the TechNet.
States, and maybe not worldwide, that gives you a good antenna engineer.
That tells you a couple of different things going on here. The schools are not keeping up with what wireless technology is doing. The subject is kind of complicated. It can be easily misunderstood. People don't have enough training. In other words, unless you've got a real good teacher, you're not going to get a good student who later on is going to turn into a good teacher. So we got a bit of a vicious cycle going on there. That's some of my opinion. Steve, let's hope your problem's a little bit easier. KC2MDB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone on the net. I hope everyone's antennas made it through the big wind we've had today. My question, Dick, is concerning vertical antennas. You know, I got the basic concept on Yagis and dipoles. My question is vertical antennas. You know, like I got this diamond outside, you know, things like 18 feet tall. I know it's collinear. But how does the ground radials work? You know, they got those like three little short ground radials. You know, to me, it's not really a balanced system. Do they use some sort of electronic match to, balance the vertical with those three little short ground radials? Back to you, Dick.
I think I see the nature of what you're asking, Steve. You really want to know where's the gain coming from, and is the gain greatly affected by those ground plane radials, and do those ground plane radials have to get longer and shorter and change in design as you change your collinear antenna, brand name, diameter, length, whatever. Gain of an antenna, whether you know it or not, is really an area relationship. On transmission, it's a little bit difficult to see, but on reception, it's a little easier to see. If I've got an isotropic antenna, make it believe it's a light bulb, and I'm radiating 100 watts, so I've got this 100 watt light bulb in the middle of a spherical room, and the area of the room, the spherical room, has 100 square meters to it, and I got 100 watts coming out of the light bulb. It's kind of obvious that the light bulb, if it's really isotropic, is sparing the power equally. Each square meter is going to have 1 watt of power. Notice the area relationship. It took a square meter of the room to absorb a portion of that 100 watts radiated by the light bulb in order for that particular square meter to get 1 watt of power and to experience that amount of heating. So in the case of a light bulb in a spherical room, with 100 square meters of area and 100 watts out of the light bulb, it becomes a little bit easier to see, I put that in quotes, what's going on. And with RF, something very similar is happening. 100 watt out of an isotropic antenna with a 100 square meter room made out of anechoic material would also get 1 watt per square meter and get that amount of heating. As you increase the area of the antenna, make it 2 square meters instead of 1 square meter. That means it's going to absorb 2 watts instead of 1 watt. It's going to absorb more signal. So there are various ways by which you can make an antenna have more gain. But when you do that, there's an exact relationship. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. The lambda squared over 4 pi is a constant. Gain is the one that's variable. So once you fix the frequency, and that 4 pi is an unchanging number, roughly 12.6, as I remember. If you want to double the gain of an antenna at your favorite frequency, you must do something to double its area. Well, in the case of a collinear antenna is a little bit like a quarter wave ground plane antenna, except you stacked another half wave of antenna above it, and depending on how many gain you want out of your collinear, you can stack another and another and another half wave radiator on top of the bottom quarter wave. You're increasing the area physically. You can see it. Let me drop. And what's really happened is that you've gone from a somewhat isotropic antenna pattern where it lights up all angles of space the same, and you've gone over to a more pancake-like pattern. By making the antenna vertically polarized and more tall vertically, and all those half-wave chunks you've added on top, if you look inside of a collinear antenna, they got a bunch of semi-rigid cable with crisscross connections, so that all those half-wave sections, each one of them is a little bit like a half-wave dipole, they're all radiating in parallel with each other. All in they're all in phase with each other. The net result is that you get a pancake-like pattern. In other words, your vertical beamwidth starts getting very narrow, even though your horizontal beamwidth stays the same, full 360 degrees. You build a real long, 18-foot long, collinear, 2-meter antenna, and you've got a few degrees of vertical bandwidth. If you could see it with your eye, that antenna pattern in three-dimensional space would look like a fat pancake. So, you squeeze down the power, that's where the gain is coming from. The quarter wave radials on the bottom are the poor man's equivalent of the ground plane. Whether it's a quarter wave ground plane antenna, a 5/8 wave, half wave, or your multi-element collinear antenna, in all cases, a collinear antenna, a vertical ground plane antenna, needs a sheet of metal to push against, the so-called counterpoise. If this is the best of all worlds, it would be a great big sheet of metal that goes in all directions for a whole lot of meters. Well, when you really produce an antenna like that, for a bunch of mechanical and cost reasons, you don't want to give it a great big sheet of metal. Let me drop. You instead put those two, three, or four radials at the bottom. Each one of those radials is electronically a quarter wavelength long. Obviously, they're open circuited at the far end, the open circuit end. A quarter wave away from an open circuit, every transmission line, everything that carries RF energy, does impedance inversion. So an open circuit at the far end becomes a short circuit at the near end, the end that attaches to the base of your collinear antenna. So those three or four radials, with their slight tilt to them and the right electrical length, present a short circuit at the center, which means that it does a pretty good job, it does 98% of the job, of stopping current from flowing down the outside of your transmission line. If you took away those three radials on your collinear antenna, you would probably lose 1 dB of gain. The antenna wouldn't stop working. But now you'd have a hot transmission line. Not all of your RF energy would be radiated by the thing you call antenna. A certain percentage of it would now be radiated by the outside of your coax cable that's feeding the antenna. So those radios do a good job, but they're not a showstopper. If you left them off, the antenna would work. The Ringo Ranger antenna, for instance, the Cushcraft Ringo Ranger, needs those ground plane radials. It doesn't have them. As such, the length of the pipe that you mount your Ringo Ranger on makes a difference on what the antenna performance is. If you happen to be one of the lucky guys that mounts it on a piece of pipe of the right length, you think the Ringo Ranger is the best antenna in the world. If you happen to be the guy that's unlucky and has the wrong length of pipe because you're launching current in the pipe, and that current on the pipe could be out of phase with the signal coming out of the antenna, you'll think the Ringo Ranger is a terrible antenna. Neither one is the exact answer. It really needs those ground plane radials. And Mr. Cushman decided to leave them off to make an antenna that looks nice, that's inexpensive to manufacture, easy to install, and you take that chance. Maybe that helps a little bit, Steve. KC2MDB. Thanks for the beep. K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Yes, very good, Dick. Yes, I understand that. But, basically I can't grasp the concept, you know, like in the antenna book, you know, to build like a simple 2-meter quarter wave antenna. You know, you got your, whatever it is, 19-inch vertical radial, and then you got your either your 3 or your 4 19-inch ground radials. I guess, a half wave, I always thought, you know, if you increase, you know, your vertical radial to half wave, you have to increase your ground radials. But you're saying that basically so long as they're a quarter wave electrically, that you're fine. Am I understanding you correct? And is there, you know, a specific number? Why are there 3 and 4, you know, do they, like, add up to a quarter wave, a half wave? Back to you, Dick.
Hey, you're using good common sense here, Steve. And this is one of the places, there's a zillion places in antennas where common sense almost doesn't work. You would think if you make the radiator quarter wave, 5/8 wave, half wave, full wave, whatever, you would be adjusting the ground plane radials accordingly. Uh-uh. In general, those ground plane radials are electronically a quarter wavelength long. Two of them would work somewhat. 3 works better. 4 would work better than that. 15 of them would work even better. You're slowly recreating that great big sheet of metal that the ground plane really wants to see. Now let me backtrack as to where this is coming from. The best fully symmetric antenna in the world is a dipole. I've got this dipole in free space being fed with a 70 ohm twin lead transmission line, and at one instant of time, I'll stop the action. The right hand side of the dipole has got a positive voltage, the left hand side has got a negative voltage. At that instant of time, and I've stopped the action, and right down the center of the dipole, at right angles to the wire, I could put a sheet of metal down the neutral plane. It would not make any difference. So I've got the sheet of metal perpendicular to my dipole, and I placed it right down the center of the dipole. You could say half of the sheet of metal is on the left side of the twin lead, and half of it's on the right side. The sheet of metal even goes down the center of the twin lead, if you want to carry this to ridiculous extremes. I would make no change in the impedance, radiation pattern, gain, nothing would change in the dipole. Once you realize that that sheet of metal down the neutral plane doesn't change anything, you can decide you're not going to feed the left-hand side of the dipole, I'm only going to feed the right-hand side, and I'm going to feed it with reference to that sheet of metal. That's a vertical ground plane antenna. And the other half of the left half of the dipole is still there, it's now the mirror image in that sheet of metal, as far as the RF is concerned. So, a dipole is really a pair of ground plane antennas back-to-back, where the sheet of metal has been eliminated because you didn't really need it. In the case of a dipole, the counterpoise is the other half of the dipole. In the case of a ground plane vertical, your counterpoise, the thing you push against, is the sheet of metal. And now, somebody a long time ago started doing, let me drop, a bunch of experiments, he started making a skeleton equivalent of the sheet of metal. And he started cutting away more and more metal. He realized that as long as he lays down a few radials, he gets 90-some-odd% of the performance of the full sheet of metal. So those radials, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them, however many you feel like putting down, making them exactly a quarter wavelength long electronically, and keeping them a quarter wavelength long, does the majority of you want it to do. Makes your radiator think it's happy, creates what it thinks is the mirror image of the other half of the dipole that really isn't there, and in so doing, it's creating a kind of a spatial short circuit right at the base of your vertical ground plane antenna, and that short circuit in space almost stops the current from flowing down the outside of the coax cable. The full sheet of metal would do a perfect job. It would be completely shielded. The 2, 3, 4 ground modules do is almost a good enough job. Back to you, Steve. KC2MDP. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I sort of get the idea now of what you're saying. It's a fix, but it's not a perfect fix. And I was thinking, like, let's say you take your dipole now, and, you know, for lack of technical terms, you have your one side that's your radiator on your dipole, the other side is your ground. Now, if you shorten the ground side of the dipole, the visoir is going to go up on that. You can't have a quarter wave, let's say, on the ground side of that dipole. But, you know, that's where I'm trying to grasp this, is you can't have a quarter wave of radials on a vertical. That's basically where you're losing me. Back to you.
Yeah, when the radials are a quarter wavelength long, they come very close to being a good short circuit. That's what you want. Make the radials longer or shorter, they don't do as good a job unless you're putting in the full sheet of metal for the ground plane, which would be the ideal ground plane. Then the length doesn't matter. But you can make Mother Nature will allow you to not use the full sheet of metal, to use a hell of a lot less hardware, as long as you're willing to keep it resonated quarter wavelength long. When you make the radiator itself, quarter wave, half wave, 5/8 wave, full wave, 40 waves, doesn't matter. The impedance of the radiator goes up and down, becomes reactive, becomes inductive. The impedance of the radiator...